So imagine this. You're walking down the street, you go down an alley, and as you're doing that, someone sticks a gun in your ribs and says, "Your money or your life." If someone said those words, what would you do? Most of us would turn over our wallets. The threat works because we value our lives more than we value money. Or do we? We're going to explore that exact topic today with the author of Your Money or Your Life, Vicki Robin.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Let me just put a few stats out there. Your Money or Your Life has sold over 1 million copies since its inception nearly 25 years ago and has been translated into 10 languages. Now, I want to say that this was not actually my introduction to the FI community, but I realize more and more that nearly my entire philosophy about money has its roots in the groundwork that Vicki Robin and Joe Dominguez laid. I'm incredibly excited about this episode. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
I am doing quite well, Jonathan. Yeah, this is a real treat for us here at Choose FI and for the FI community generally to have Vicki Robin, who, as our friend Christy from Millennial Revolution calls, the Eve of the Adam and Eve of financial independence. I mean, she's here on the podcast and we get to talk to her today. It's really just such a fortunate position to be in. And this was a book that I read growing up. I know it was published in 1992. I don't remember precisely when I read it, but I remember the lessons, and that's the most important part. And yeah, it's really a fundamental piece of the FI community. And incredibly, Vicki has updated it and is now a part of this modern day financial independence community. So with that, Vicki Robin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad to be with you guys, and thank you for your work.
Trust me when I say the honor is all ours. What came to mind?
No. It's authored mine. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. I stand corrected.
That's going to happen a lot in the next hour, Jonathan.
Yeah, I know. So Vicki, I wanted to there's so many places to take this, but in my mind, the most stark thing is that you did this body work. You dedicated your life to it. You dedicated your heart and your soul to it. And in some form, at some point in time, you were no longer attached to it. In fact, you were even questioning, my understanding is you're recovering from surgery, just questioning what's going on with it. And you have the realization that there's a vibrant community that has risen up around this work. I mean, I would love to hear that from your perspective.
I don't know how far back to go. I was born in 1945. No, you don't need to know that. Basically, I met Joe in just about 1970 when I was burning through a bunch of savings, as many people do when they're young, when they're 23 or 24, just to have the great adventure of going on the road. And I met him and he basically said to me, you know, you can take the money that you're wasting now and you could invest it in long-term bonds. At that point, long-term bonds were 9%, eat your hearts out. And so I did that. I became FI at a very modest level. You know, I had about $125 a month. But at that point, that was adequate for the kind of life I was willing to live. And I really wanted freedom, and I wanted my time, and I wanted my mind, and I wanted my attention way more than I wanted money. And I had learned that lesson early in life. So anyway, there we are. Fast forward, after a couple decades, I wanted people to have access to Joe's knowledge about money because I hadn't heard anything as brilliant, and it really opened my life up. So together he created his basic approach to money into a 9-step program. There was no 9-step program. There's just what he did. And I started producing seminars. And this was started in 1980, I guess, so that it was only a decade. So we did those seminars for about 3 or 4 years, and we decided that we would give away all the money. Because if we took money for the seminars, it would negate the fact that we were financially independent. It would say, like, well, we were financially independent, but now we need money. So we just, you know, we were sort of edgy We were not sort of edgy. We were edgy and decided we would give all the money away and started a foundation in order to do that, you know, to basically take fees and give money away. And we gave away over time $1 million.
Wow.
In 800 small grants over the course of a decade or two, actually. So we taught it as a live seminar, and then we put it on tape with a workbook. And so between those two, we had sold about 20,000 people had been exposed by 1989, which is the date I'm trying to get to in this story. Up until that time, it had simply been a strategy to liberate people from what we used to call making a dying. You know, we just wanted to help people who really had a sense that there was more to life than the 9-to-5 grind. Then I went to the first North American conference on this idea that was fairly new at the time called sustainable development. The leaders, you know, people from the United Nations who traveled the world studying this issue of the collision course between environmental integrity and economic growth in the 1980s. So a dozen commissioners from that commission spoke, and the heads of all the environmental organizations, and they all said the single biggest driver of our eventual planetary demise is the level and pattern of consumption in North America. And then they would shrug. They would go like, well, nobody can touch that. You know, this country, it's right to consume. It's our right to consume. You just can't get between an American and their desire to consume, because that's un-American. It sort of has ended up being our only shared religion.
As you're going through the story, you're drawing so many different themes for the book, and I'd really like to jump into a few of them and not miss this in the process. Like you made this statement, we aren't making a living, we're making a dying. Could you, for our audience, like, let's just assume that the audience hasn't read Your Money or Your Life. They're finding out about financial independence through us. And in my case, I found out about financial independence through maybe some of the predecessors to us, like Mr. Money Mustache and Mad Scientist, and they found about it from you. Many of these ideas and thoughts come directly from this 1992 book. What does it mean, you aren't making a living, you're making a dying?
Well, basically, the observation is, if you were making a living, that you would be more alive at the end of a day at the workplace. You've made some living. But the observation was that people were more dead at the end of the day. And so we chose to call it making a dying to like capture people's actual honest experience. Because people get it. You know, if a Martian came down to Earth and they observed, you know, if there was such a thing as a Martian, and they observed, they said like, okay, these little sort of squishy things get into these little metal things and they go back and forth to something they call work. And when they come back, they're dead, you know, and then they sleep for a while, they come alive and they go back and they go to this thing called work and then they're dead again. From the Martian point of view, it is making a dying. At the same time, you know, it's just today I read about a new book called Dying for a Paycheck. And basically the author, Jeffrey Pfeiffer, did a 2015 paper on the health effects of making a dying. And literally people are dying. I mean, people are, the annual healthcare costs of the stress of the making a dying world is astronomical. So that's, you know, confirmation from studies of the metaphor that we use. So that's what why we called it making and dying. And this is not to dismiss the many values of work and not to dismiss that there are people for whom their jobs are their life's work. It's not to make jobs wrong. It's just an observation of the cost of this tunnel that most people in our society are run down.
Yeah.
Which is called making a dying.
You know, I certainly see that as well. And I wonder, you know, you were talking just a second ago about this American right to consume. And I think many of us just kind of take it for granted. But I think there is some evidence to support the fact that consumers were created. This is not unintentional. There's a purpose behind this mentality. And I think that comes through in your book.
Absolutely. Yeah. So basically, until the last century, because so much of what we had came from human labor, there was surplus was only for kings and queens. And so people's idea of consumption was to get absolutely what they needed, you know, an axe, you know, a plow, a, you know, and some of these things people actually made, you know, bolt of calico. There was no thought of excess. And so sometime around the 1920s, according to a book by Benjamin Honeycutt, sometimes around the 1920s, we hit overproduction. There were no markets for the volume of products that were coming out of the Industrial Revolution. So the Hoover Commission, Herbert Hoover, assembled a commission to take a look at this and said, you know, like, we've got to do something about this. And they realized that they could actually expand it to foreign markets, or they could train consumers in the United States, people in the United States, to want more than enough. And that was like the beginning of advertising. And actually, the expansion of advertising after World War II came from some of the research that was done on mind control by the Nazis. So basically, yeah, we have been created to be consumers. And I don't have any statistic now about how many ads a day we see. It's way more than when we first published the book. And it's aided and abetted by a drug, like a major drug that has been introduced in the last 40 years into our society that we don't even see as a drug. We see as a necessity. It's called unsecured debt or credit cards.
So, Vicky, I'm curious. Obviously, you're painting this picture of this creation of this consumer class, that Americans aren't citizens anymore, but consumers. And if we take that as a given, as a societal given now, that people are basically bred to be these consumers, how do you unwind that? How do you approach someone and try to, I guess, break them free of the matrix, if you will? How does that approach work on like a real granular level?
What I have found with Your Money, Your Life, the years that we did of teaching, is that the fulcrum of the transformation is this idea of hourly wage. We see money as an endless supply. You know, when you're younger, you just think you're going to keep working. You're in the middle of your life. You don't think about stopping, you know, having a paycheck. So money seems like something it can always replenish, always replenish. And we don't realize that we're trading the hours of our life, the actual hours of our life, for money, and our lives are limited. We have, you know, maybe someplace between, I hate saying this because I'm 72, but, you know, I mean, on average, about 80 years, you know, that you might have on this planet. So what we unfurl in Your Money, Your Life is that of those 80 years, you'll spend 20 just getting prepared for life. Okay, so just those are off. And then you'll spend a third of the remaining years sleeping. And so you just take those years off, or those hours. So we're down to 40 years, and maybe you're 40 years old when you discover this, you know, so you're down to about 20 years. So, I mean, you start to whittle this down about how much time do I actually have to do all the things I want to do, to mate, marry, have children, raise a family, to learn and grow, maybe study for a decade and have a profession, whether it's law or medicine, and go on to get advanced degrees, you know, or academia. These are the things that I imagined for myself, or I imagined for myself when I was younger. What do you want to do when you grow up? And you imagine those things. You don't imagine, I want to sleep for a third of my life, and then I want to make a dying, you know, after I've taken out the garbage and cooked dinner and done the dishes and driven my kids to school and done my errands and stuff like, and done the laundry, right? You know, you don't think that that's what you want out of life. You think you want something grander.
Yeah. But what happens is it gets traded in, I think, based on this idea of marketing, this idea of creating consumers. I'm grabbing this stat from your book, from your update. The average American child from age 2 to 11 sees more than 25,000 advertisements per year. We celebrate shows like Mad Money that basically are advertising to us the process that was going on behind the scenes to transform, to make this cultural shift. And on top of that, if you really wanted to bring it down to its roots, just go to and look at the, in your book, you talk about analyzing this pattern of beliefs. What do you do when you're bored? You buy something. What do you do when you're stressed out? You buy something. What do you do when you need to get out of your grind. You go buy something. I would love to kind of hear you explore that a little bit further.
Sure. And I can do that in the context of this idea of real hourly wage. But basically, once you realize that your life is limited and that you have only a certain number of hours to do everything you want, then your hours become precious and you start to guard them. And so when you spend money, you better spend money on something that's going to actually make you happy, improve your life, and take you in the direction you want to go. It is a natural self-preservation act. And so waking up from the matrix, to me, that awareness, and then also what we spin out, the real hourly wage, is not only, you know, are you making like $25 an hour, whatever you're making, but a third of that, or quarter to a third, is going to go to taxes. I mean, you start whittling down the expenses that you have to pay just for the privilege of earning that money, and you start adding into your 40 hours a week or 60 or whatever, the extra hours in commuting and this and that and the other thing. You do that whole calculation, and most people realize they're making a quarter of what they thought they were making. So an hour of your life is worth $7.50, your two lattes. That's it. That's an hour of your life. So you start, you know, that's when you start going like, I could make coffee at home and bring it in a thermos. Yeah. Because it's self-preservation. It weans you from, it wakes you up from that sleepwalking behavior. And so you're going to, like, there was a woman who followed our program, and she wrote us a letter, and she said, after she read the book, she went into her closet, and she had something like 28 white blouses, and some of them still had tags on them. And she realized that every Friday after work, she would go to the mall and buy a white blouse, forgetting that she had a white blouse. As a matter of fact, she had, you know, 10 others, because she had this addiction to white blouses, until she did the program and she realized, I don't even wear those things. That's what we call gazingus pins. You know, the things that you buy, you're in the presence of your gazingus pin and you just completely go unconscious, even though you have another 10. Mm. You know, for me, one of my gazingus pins was gazingus pens. I have way too many pens, but I have this association of pens and the school year, and I always liked learning. So buying a pen for me had some quality to it of I was going to learn something and I was going to be serious and I was going to buckle down. And, you know, it's just all it was another piece of the planet, a little something that went into the pen drawer. So this to me is the deprogramming aspect of it. And if people only do that calculation, I guarantee they're going to change the way they consume.
Vicky, I think most people like to think that they're rational and that they think through things. And I think we all know that that's not entirely the case, including myself, including I'm sure you. Like, we all have these levels of irrationality. I'm curious, like a woman like that who had those 28 white blouses, what do you think leads to that? Does she legitimately not know that she had 27 other white blouses in the closet? You use the word deprogramming. That was a very stark word to me. Like, I'd love to hear your thoughts, obviously, on that one particular woman, just but writ large. What does that mean for the culture?
Well, so you've asked two questions. Where does it come from and what does it mean for the culture? Where it comes from, I would bet, as they say, dollars to donuts, that it comes from childhood experiences of some sort of deprivation, lack, trauma that wasn't processed consciously, and maybe a parent who said, oh, don't cry, honey, we'll go out to the mall. And, you know, we don't know where it comes from, but because it's a cultural habit, it's something that's learned. I would guess that it comes from those moments. My observation of myself is that I often go unconscious when I'm having strong feelings about something, but I don't want to feel my feelings. Just to take an example of eating. You know, if I was utterly conscious, I probably wouldn't have a cookie ever. But, you know, there's moments when I'm between things, I'm at odds, I was disturbed about something I read or something that happened, and I might turn to food. You know, why do I do that? Well, I learned when I was a child from a mother who overate that that's how you deal with stress. So I think these are habits that were formed in childhood and that have gone into the unconscious. And it's how we deal with lack, stress, disappointment, almost every emotion other than happiness. And even happiness, we deal with it through consumption.
You know, and I think as you're pointing that out, it became very real to me that you're absolutely right. It's very easy to point at the person that goes and they purchase the dresses and you're like, well, I would just never do that. Gosh, who are you even talking about? But then you move it to food and you realize that, wow, that's a blind spot for you personally, that you make decisions on a regular basis that don't serve your ultimate goals. One of the things that kind of brings all of these different choices together was this fulfillment curve that you highlighted in the book. It speaks basically to this point of diminishing returns. And I'd love to hear how that built into this framework you've built.
Mm. So Joe developed this heuristic device called the fulfillment curve as a way to explain that more is not always better. You know, we have this more is better mentality because it totally serves the consumer culture. And so every time we're disturbed, we're between things, we're dissatisfied. You know, there's this moment where this little meme, more is better, comes in. And then we go and get the more that we think would be better. And for a minute, it is better. But then we still think more is better. It's like a formula for dissatisfaction. But we don't make that a conscious. So this is a graph that he developed, which is the relationship between money spent and stuff acquired. That's the across the bottom axis. And then the vertical axis is happiness, satisfaction. There is a kind of cheap thrill that we get from the moment of purchase where you want something, you're in the store. You go in the store, you don't know what you want. And then you see something, you go like, oh, I want that. And so you put in your cart and you take it and you give them your credit card and suddenly it's yours and you can walk out the store with it. And there is that little moment, that little cheap thrill of like, ooh, I got what I wanted. Very often the cheap thrills will disappear by the time you get to the trunk of your car in the parking lot. It's just something else. And that's how the white blouses happen. But what we're talking about with satisfaction is it's something that truly makes you happy, that you will use up, that you will use it until it's threadbare because you like it so much. You know, your Carhartt jacket, whatever, you know, your Keen shoes, whatever those things are for you, that you wear them out because you love them. And it's also things that really serve your life, things that you might use on a daily basis, like the really, really, really nice cooking pot. So it serves your life, makes you happy. This is what we're talking about in that vertical axis. And so we go, it's like, it's a developmental thing, you know, so early on in your consumption, whether it's, you know, going from a baby to being 7 years old, pretty much you have a need, you're disturbed, and the need gets filled. You get a blanket, you get a bottle, you get a bed, you sleep, you know, your diapers change, whatever it is, it's not much consumption and a great deal of satisfaction. So there's a beginning of the programming. Ah, I need something. It comes from the outside and I'm happy. And then there is sort of and we call those your survival needs. And you could do this developmentally also in terms of culture. You know, it's food, clothing, and shelter. You know, people who are refugees living in refugee camps who barely have a roof over their head, are barely eating. Their entire daily lives are about filling those very basic needs. And once they have it, once they're out of the rain, once they have a good meal, there's a tremendous amount of satisfaction. Then there's the next layer, say, you know, from 7 years old to 17 years old. That layer of consumption is what I call like self-expression. Like you want to play baseball and you get a baseball mitt, or you get a bicycle, or you get a Barbie doll, or you know, to play with your friends, or you know, goes up from your bicycle and maybe, you know, you're going up and you get your first car, and you know, it's like everybody remembers their first car. But most people don't remember their third, fourth, or fifth car because it's just a car. So you have all these firsts of things that you acquire that make you feel older and more powerful, and you can go further and you can impress other people. So it's all, these are all things that are acquired that continue to bring you happiness, maybe not as much happiness per unit of money spent as your bottle, but definitely the curve is going up. So the programming is being reinforced. I get something and I get happy. then there's like this third layer of consumerism that maybe, you know, you, this layer that I was talking about goes until you graduate from college. And then you go out in the world and you get your second car, maybe your third car, or whatever. These are what we call luxuries. These are things that really add to your life, but they're not adding to your life with the same degree of excitement and happiness as your baseball mitt. You know, they're maybe necessary. You get your first apartment. Wow. And then you think your first apartment is too small. And so you get something better in a better neighborhood. And it's still a wow. But then you get to this certain point where you really have everything you need when you come down to it fundamentally. But you now are programmed to think, ah, if I feel some anxiety, if I feel like, I don't know, something's not right in my life, I'll bet if I buy something, that'll work. So you go out and you buy a house, right? You think, ah, that's what's going to make me happy. I don't want to be a renter. I want to be an owner. And so you buy this thing, you know, and it's got, you know, then you're a homeowner and you have all these homeowner expenses. And that's how you're spending your Saturdays, is like fixing the fascia or fixing the plumbing. And suddenly the thing that you own owns you. But you don't go like, oh, that was a mistake to get the house. You go like, ah, house wasn't it. Maybe it's car. So you get the car, and then, you know, the first scratch, the first dent of your Lexus, boom. Oh, it wasn't that. Ah, I know it's not things, it's experiences. I'll go to this like week-long workshop in Ecuador. That'll do it for me, or whatever, you know. So, oh, and then, you know, it was nice, but it rained all the time, and you come home and you're still the same old person you were. And you think, ah, it's not experiences, it's personal growth. I'm going to go and I'm going to have therapy. And you just keep that process of consuming, thinking it's going to bring you the satisfaction that you felt way back with that baseball mitt. And you're just going down the far side of that fulfillment curve. And so we talk about that place at the top of the fulfillment curve where you have everything you want and need for your survival, for your comforts, for some luxuries. I mean, it's abundance. It's not overabundance or underabundance, it's abundance. And our word for that is enough. We have enough, and everything that you buy or invest your time or money in beyond your enough point is really just clutter. And we also make the point with the fulfillment curve is that the happiness line goes up and up and up. But happiness eventually, once you have enough, doesn't come from what you're getting. It comes from what you're giving. It comes from your creativity. It comes from relationships. It comes from your participation in making life better for people you love and the world around you. That's what makes life worth living, you know, or learning something new and sharing it with other people. That's where all the joy is. But if you keep your focus on what you buy as your source of happiness, you're actually going to, over time, degrade your capacity to be happy, not exercise your participation muscle at all, just buy things that other people have created, and off you go, RIP, into the grave. So that's a verbal description of this idea of the fulfillment curve, and that's the aim of what we're teaching, is how much is enough, and how do you know? And so by basically doing that real hourly wage calculation and asking of your purchases, is this part of my enough? And not lying to yourself, going like, is it going to make me happy, really happy? Is it going to serve my life? Is it going to take me where I want to go? And what would this expense look like if I were financially independent? You know, some of our spending is simply on the job costuming. Some of our spending is compensatory spending because, you know, you want to reward yourself for a hard week. Some of it is going out to restaurants all the time because you don't have time to cook. Some of it is your therapy because you're so dissatisfied with your job. You know, there's a lot of spending, actually, and this is like a message for FIers, a lot of spending falls away once you're FI.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask real quickly about that peak point, that enough point. So obviously, if someone's going through this fulfillment curve, which is really just living their life, they are not looking down on this from on high. They're just living their life. What can they take away as, what should I look for to know I've reached that peak of the curve?
Right. So most of us overshoot. Most of us in the United States are not deprived. We don't have less than enough. Most of us who do this program arrive there with more than enough. So one thing that we suggest, the first thing you do is you do an inventory of your what you have, the money and stuff. And some people have taken years on it because they don't want to go in the garage. So just even the observation of the too muchness in your life will help.
And to be clear, what you're actually suggesting is to track every single penny that you have ever earned, right? I mean, that's how much money has actually flown through your hands and then comparing what you have to show for it.
Exactly. You know, your dial, your sort of dial of the intensity of this program is the precision of the program. So you can guesstimate to the nearest dollar or the nearest $10, you know, assigning value to the things you have, the generator that you bought during the storm of 08 that you never even learned to start. Those things, those things that so many of us have that we bought because we wanted to solve a problem, but we never used them. Yeah, so just even inventorying your stuff, just the first pass, walk around your living room, squat down and look under your kitchen counters. Is there stuff there that you haven't used in 5 years, but you don't want to let go of? In part because you don't want to admit that you bought something that you didn't need. So as long as you keep it squirreled away, you can still pretend, someday I'm going to need that thing. And I'm not talking about minimalism. I'm not talking getting down to 3 shirts in your closet. I'm simply talking about the reckoning that we do with the stuff that we have that we don't use, don't need, and is just clogging up our lives. So doing that first step of doing your balance sheet can be a moment when you realize your habit of too muchness. Or it can be, there was one person who was about to buy a new car. You know, she had her hand over the check to write to the car company, and she went, I have a car. You know, it was just noticing that you have what you need. That prevented an expense that would have taken like 3 to 5 years of her life to pay off, if you look at the real hourly wage and the cost of a new car.
Yeah.
So it's these moments. And the key, and I'm like, there's too many things that I call a key, but one of the keys is the mantra that we suggest of no shame, no blame. So you're sitting there and you're about to write the check and you realize you already have a car. And instead of going, you idiot, you go like, oh God, wasn't that funny? You know, there's no shame, no blame. It's just something you did.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. Because you didn't love your mother, your mother didn't love you, or because you saw an ad on television, or because your best friend has one, or whatever the drivers are. It's just forgive yourself in advance and just do it. Just start looking. And then you can sell some of that stuff in the garage sale. You get a lot of money for that generator that you never started.
But I think that everything that we've talked about up to this point really does give us the foundation. It's only once you really have established these two ideas that now it makes sense to start talking about your real hourly rate. And putting that in the context of your money or your life, you're basically saying, how much are you trading your life energy for? It seems to me like that was the defining principle, that money is something that you trade your life energy for. Let's just set this example up as this above median income earner. Let's just pick on pharmacy. The guy is making somewhere between $50 to $60 an hour. How does that individual go from saying, all right, I'm making 50 or 60 bucks to actually calculating their real hourly rate? What different things would you have them consider when calculating that?
Well, you start with taxes. At that rate, you might be, well, I don't know what the new tax laws are, but let's just say we're taking 25 to 30% off the top. So let's just say that $60 an hour is down to $40 an hour. Oh, no, that's too much. Okay, $42.
I'm okay with that. We can just go with 40. Let's start there.
Nice round number.
I was thinking, you know, people are so resistant to this sort of facing reality. They don't want to do it. Okay, so we're going to say $40 an hour. Then you take into account, what are the expenses that you have associated with your job? I don't know whether it's true for dentists, but many people in the health professions have to get continuing education credit to keep their licenses. So every time you have to do a course, you go to a conference and you get continuing education credits for attending a workshop. And that's just all part of the deal. You've gone to the conference, you spent like $800 on your flight, and you spent $1,000 to go to the conference. And so that $1,800 is part of the expense of earning your money, just for an example. Or, you know, for your dentist, how many little white jackets does he need, you know, or the equipment for his office? I mean, talk about an expense. So these are all expenses associated with your dental practice.
And in the case of maybe a lawyer or some other profession, it's not just that, it's the suits. I mean, you are expected to maintain a certain level of appearance or dress code. That would have to be factored in too, right?
Exactly. All of this gets factored in. No shame, no blame, not wrong that you have your little white coats or your, you know, like $1,000 suits, nothing wrong with it. It just gets factored in. And then also factored in is the extra time you spend associated with your job, which be that weekend conference, or it's just your commute time, or the time it takes you at the end of the day, you know, whether it's meditation or having a vodka, you know, whatever it is, it's that period of time at the end of the day when you're just sort of like reclaiming yourself as a human from the stress of your profession. So you subtract from that $60 an hour, the prorate, the hourly annual, you go like my annual cost for being a dentist divided by X number of hours. So you add in the hours and you subtract the costs from your $40 an hour because we've already done taxes. So once you do that, very often people find that their real hourly wage is on average a quarter of what they think they're making.
So to be clear on that, what you're saying is once you subtract the taxes and the other thing, it's not just that, like if your initial hourly rate was based on a 40-hour work week, but in reality, you're between your commute and the overtime and the extra stuff that you're putting in and the preparation for the different off-hour activities, you're putting in an extra 10 to 15 hours a week. You need to factor that in. And that is having a direct impact on your hourly rate.
Right. And you will get it down. That $60 an hour may get down to $15 an hour, or it may be less. I mean, we've had people write to us and say, I thought I was making $120 an hour, but I'm making $2.75, like $2.75. Huh. You know, this can be criticized. This is what's called a heuristic device. It's a way to get a clarity on something that is invisible. You can argue with the taxes or you can argue with any piece of this, but just in general, people find that their real hourly wage is about a quarter of what they thought they were earning. So here we have this dentist who thinks he's making $60 an hour. And so taking his wife and kids out to a nice restaurant on Friday night and spending $120 looks like 2 hours, but it's really a full day's work. Wow. And so once he starts thinking about that, he might think about a different restaurant or ordering in, or going out for dessert, you know, and having a pot roast at home or whatever. You start to like go like, that's not worth it to me. If it was 2 hours of my life, it's easy. You know, that's like two patients. But if it's 8 hours of my life, well, that's a whole day of my life.
What really struck me as I was thinking this through, going back to that idea of the fulfillment curve, you know, if you're calculating what you need on every possible luxury that you could ever buy. If you're calculating how much you need to save to be able to afford your clutter, what really comes to mind is the opportunity cost of all of that extra time that you have to work and how unnecessary it really is if you can figure out what is enough actually look like for your specific situation.
I love that you use the word opportunity cost because that's where another piece of this comes in, where in our society, very often we meet somebody, say, what do you do? And they say, I'm a plumber, I'm a lawyer, I'm a dentist. We identify with what we do on our jobs, and our jobs occupy an ever larger proportion, not only of our time, but our sense of our worth, our status, our ability to attract people to us who we would like to know, our creativity, our self-expression. There's a whole range of human needs, our relationships, and we put so many of those needs in our job. You know, it's our community, it's our team, it's our self-expression, it's our identity, it's our status, and it's our income. And so what happens with this program is you start to think about, who am I beyond my job? What are the goals I have that aren't job related? To raise a family or to travel the world or to paint. I used to love to paint when I was 7 years old. I want to paint or to become an actor and be in a Hollywood movie or be in an independent movie. There's so many identities we have, so many identities, so many human needs that get put on the shelf, that get crowded out because we're investing so much in our job. The consumer culture hides the fact that there is an opportunity cost and everything's a trade-off because money seems limitless. You have it, and even if you don't have it, you can use the credit card. So you can have whatever you want. But the fact of the matter is you're trading the hours of your life that you could be investing in something that's equally, if not more, important to you. So important. So important. It becomes invisible until you start using these tools, and then it's glaring. And that's why when people get on the FI path, they like save 20% easily. Then they save 30% with, you know, some application of self. And then they go like, ah, the more money I save, the sooner I get out. And then they become hyper savers. And there are people who are like saving 90% of their paycheck because they want to reclaim their time more quickly.
So Vicky, this is really a reorientation on how people approach life. First, having that understanding that your money is really your life energy. So, I mean, that's a huge thing in and of itself. And then second, like you're saying here, what do you do? You hear that question all the time. And you're really saying, turn that on its head and say, what do you want out of life? And really, is it worth spending this time at these jobs to that you're giving up your most precious resource, which is your life energy?
Right. And there's something a bit deeper that I've been thinking about. Maybe it's deeper, maybe it's broader, is that we confuse work, job, and income. And as I was saying, work is whatever we do that makes a difference. You know, whether you're pushing a rock and you move the rock, that makes a difference. The rock's moved. Or whether you volunteer for a political candidate and win or lose, you've really put yourself on the line for your political views. Anywhere in that spectrum, that's work. It's applying yourself towards a goal that you recognize is a value. Yeah, work is not just that sort of dedication of self to something you say is worthwhile, but it is also how you learn to work and play well with others. You know, it's your training in reducing your egoic tendencies and working together and seeing what a common cause is. It's creative expression. It's drawing up something from the well of yourself and putting it into your work. It's supporting your family. It's producing an income. And in some way, it's that, you know, that phrase, that common phrase of, what I have is God's gift to me. What I give is my gift to God. It's that sense that your life is about more than just your needs, wants, and desires. That's your work. Now, your job is something you do to produce an income. It's not your work. So with the FI community, what we realize is that, oh, I could take the money from my job and invest it and have passive income so I can separate income from daily activity. Brilliant. You have an income and you get to do your work in life, which could be forming great relationships or, you know, some brilliant innovation that you do. This is so important that we are not just lone wolves out there for our own personal agenda, for our own personal needs, wants, and desires. Lives shine when people discover how to be of service. This is what Albert Schweitzer said, you know, at the end of his life, somebody said, what's your one sentence? And he said, I don't know what your destiny will be, but the one thing I know is that those of you who are going to be happy will have sought and found how to serve.
And I completely agree. The implications of breaking this link between what you do, your work, and your purpose is paramount. And I think there is a piece of us that all of us are probably guilty of this, of viewing unpaid activity as worth less than paid activity, right? I read that specifically in your book and couldn't agree more. And it's a bias that all of us have. This unwinds that, and it allows you to view things through really a true lens.
when you think about it, the work of the world is much greater than the jobs of the world. The work of the world is dating, mating, marrying, raising a family, whether it's, you know, a bunch of friends who move in together. Whatever this unit is, the unit that you make is, that is an essential need that society has. Society is not a society with a whole bunch of lone wolves. That is work. Education is work. Preparing yourself for earning income and for becoming a citizen and becoming useful in this world, that's like 18 to 22 years of your life. And that is work. It's not easy to learn, you know, multiplication. That's work. You work. So caring for children, caring for elders, caring for sick friends, this is your work to become a better human being, to grow in love and purpose. I mean, the work of the world is immense. And the fact that we don't value that, if it's not producing an income, is an inversion. And I don't know if it's something that some nefarious person cooked up. But the point is not to bring all the caring activities into paid employment. The point is to somehow recognize the value of human love and creativity and honor that as a society. So all of these things are just turning things on their head. And when you think about it, you realize this is common sense.
So Vicky, in there, you were talking about families and about units, and it reminded me of the larger thought of community. We talk a ton about community here on the podcast, that it's so sorely lacking in American society, where we're these little islands unto ourselves. And, you know, you're in suburbia and you don't live within a couple hundred feet of anybody else or see anybody other than maybe waving to them once a week or some such. And we are really trying to foster a community here in the financial independence world. I'm so curious what your thoughts were when you found this new FI community. And, you know, you had really started this, but I think you, as you put it, you kind of went away onto a literal island for a while, and now you're back, right? Like, it's amazing. And just talk to me about, like, what happened when you found the new FI community.
Oh, wow. There's so much to that question. So finding, and I love that it's called FI, and we didn't call it FI, we call it FI, financial independence, but it's called FI now. And it was like, I didn't learn that until I met Brandon. I was so excited to meet people who had liberated their minds from a lot of these delusional thoughts and realized they could get out. There was a joy in finding people who valued reality more than the illusion. And I have felt a great kinship with people on this path, some, of course, more than others. And the more the leaders and practitioners are dedicated to service, the more affiliated I feel. And so it's wonderful to be seen and to have a global community I can support. I do want to say that I live on an island, and because of the boundaries of an island, even though there's a ferry and there's a bridge, it's a large island. And when you recognize that you're in a bounded situation, that there's a shoreline and you can't walk on water, you turn toward one another more naturally than you do on the mainland. And so we have a very strong community on this island. We have a lot of local grown institutions that help people out when they're sick or, you know, volunteering. I think every board on this island is dominated by people who are retired and they don't need the money, or who are willing to dedicate that extra time to nonprofit boards. So I have come to learn, I call it community is currency. And I do have a whole section in the new Your Money, Your Life about this, about the other forms of wealth other than money, that I think money is too thin a stock unto which to rest your FI. I think community and the mutual aid and reciprocity in a community, whether it's online or face-to-face, is a really important part of being able to unhook from the economy as your basic trough for feeding whatever needs you have. And then I also think that with people like Pete, you know, Mr. Money Mustache, he really demonstrates that your competencies become part of your FI. If you can build things, if you can build relationships, if you can build houses, if you can, all of that is part of your capacity to live well on less money. And the sense of the people who are really close to you, you know, what I call belonging, you know, people who claim you as their own. When you cultivate those relationships, you'll find that a lot of the expenses of isolation go away. I had a hip surgery a year ago, and I had friends come in morning, noon, and night. They did my laundry. They cooked food. We sat around and talked. It was wonderful. And I've seen other people through surgeries here or needs or babies or whatever. And this mutual aid is really fantastic among people who actually love each other.
I'm really curious. I wanted to almost bring this back full circle to when you're in this commission and you hear them talking about the world's biggest problem that they're facing being this consumption issue. And, you know, you're standing there with really, and honestly, a lot of dignitaries, and your body of work basically solves this issue. And, you know, this was almost 20 years ago now. And we know that at this particular point in time, even though you had the momentum, even though you had people that, whose lives were being transformed by this message, these ideas, for whatever reason, the world didn't capture it. And I'm wondering, what is your take going back from sitting there in that room, the same level of excitement that I hope you have right now, but now it's present day, it's 2018, the internet and web 2.0, social media, it has never been easier to share ideas. What is your perception of where the FI community goes from here? Does this have the ability to transform the world? And do we have advantages that you didn't have 20 years ago?
This is what I learned from my first time round. At one point, because I was in Oprah twice, I was in all the morning shows, New York Times, People Magazine. When we added up the readership or audience of all the different media outlets that we had been on, it was half the nation. Now, of course, some of those are repeats, you know, it's like, but still, it was like half the population of this country. And we were like thinking, we're going to change the world. What I realized was personal change is necessary, but not sufficient. I think people in this FI path are realizing, they realize the excess in society, they're freeing themselves. But now we need to take a look at actually becoming a movement, because a movement starts to have influence society. It's not just an aggregate of individuals, it's a shared agenda. So I started asking, what would be a shared agenda for the FI community? Well, you start with universal healthcare. And basically, anybody you meet in the FI community who is not in the United States, this is laughable. Of course they have it. It takes years off their journey to FI, because they don't have to account for the possibility of spending like $500 to $1,000 a month just on the insurance. So I think this is something we could all get behind. It's obvious. It's like conservatives and liberals and Bernie-crats, everybody understands that at some basic level, healthcare for all is a right, because we have access to incredible medical system and everybody should have access. And we're just stuck. So that's the first thing that I would really encourage us all to include, like see what the barriers in our own minds are and start to think about it. And then the second thing I think is for FIers is a big barrier to FI is graduating from college with hyper debt, because it adds years to your FI to flatten that debt. So I would say that the second agenda is, if not free, you know, back to state colleges and universities, that if you were a resident for very little, you could go to college, you could get a degree, you could get your diploma and get the percent increase in your lifetime earnings that people who have a college education get. Now, the third thing is a little bit more radical, but I am fascinated with it, and I think it's super important, is the idea of a universal basic income. And I'm not talking about, you know, $30,000 a year for every man, woman, and child. I'm talking about some financial floor that is thrown off by the productivity of our society, of our commonwealth, you know, like the roads and the bridges and technology. I mean, Warren Buffett didn't do this. Bill Gates didn't do it. They just developed businesses that could profit from our commonwealth. So we should be able to harvest some money from our commonwealth to be able to create a fund like Social Security for everybody. This is a big agenda. Not everybody agrees on it, but it's really interesting because from all the way from hyper lefty people to hyper right libertarians, there's an interest in this. The tech, you know, Bill Gates says we should tax robots. You know, it's not like the corporation that has the robots should profit completely from the robots, because those robots have replaced 10 people. You know, they should take some social responsibility for the jobs they eliminated. So this time around, I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just betting on certain reasonable, rational public policies that could help everybody climb out of this hole.
And Vicki, I certainly think that the first two legs that you mentioned, the healthcare and college, we have talked over and over again on this podcast about how they're very obviously broken. People of good faith can debate over how to fix them, but I think the FI community generally understands that those are major societal issues. And yeah, the universal basic income, that's something that is brand new to me. I've certainly read a little bit about it, but yeah, clearly healthcare and college are two absolutely pressing issues that I think we as a FI community can help fix in some regard. I agree.
I'm curious from like a network perspective, with the ability for bloggers to share ideas, to share these principles, to share really these heuristic diagrams that we were talking about earlier and how to make them actionable into like an individual's life. Do you feel that the FI community, which you identified as a subculture and potentially a movement, do you think that this has the ability to become mainstream?
I don't know. I don't know if it would become mainstream as FI, or it will become mainstream because many liberated individuals freely associated will invest themselves in many issues for the common good. That's going to make a big difference. And, you know, I mean, guys have millions of followers. I mean, that's stunning. There's millions of people who are up to this. And, you know, I love that people are starting to gather. I think that's really useful. I think the more we can set up local groups who can support each other, with my business partner Grant of Millennial Money, I've developed a series of 52 questions, you know, that correspond with 52 weeks of the year, 52 cards in a deck. It's called Money Talks. It's all of them are unloaded questions that people can pose to one another as pillow talk, as family meals, as Thanksgiving, as book groups, as, you know, whatever, workshops that people can ask one another that helps people think about their relationship with money and also doing it together. It makes such a difference when you talk to other people about what's actually going on in your lives. So I think that would be a really important piece, whether it's using these Money Talk cards or whatever. There is a big need for that. And every time you do that, you realize there's people right around me. There's, you know, 16 people at my workplace who are into this. How would I have known? Because we're all hiding out.
When you were saying that, I was really struck by the fact that we actually have 140 local groups all around the world. This is something that I would love for you to pilot with them. I mean, those sorts of conversations are exactly the type of conversations that we want to see fostered. I think there's an incredible value there.
Vicki, that would be great. These questions are sprinkled throughout the New Year Money Your Life with instructions, you know, basic instructions on dialogue, which I think people need, because a lot of times we debate, which has bat in it, like we beat each other up. Yeah, or you have people who constitute themselves as experts and they dominate the conversation and they make everybody else feel stupid. So certain rules for dialogue and then these questions, but the Money Talk cards will be like a little portable product that you can carry with you. And there's lots of suggestions on our website that's not launched yet, but it will be soon, for how to use those cards. Every time I bring them out in a workshop or a conference, it's over. People, all they want to do is use the cards.
Well, Vicki, normally this would be the end of the episode, but on this show, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
Sure.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption. Trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation. These questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Vicky, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own. I guess you said yours hasn't launched yet, but your favorite blog generally.
Well, you're going to see my politics now, because the places I go are places that can give me the news that isn't in the mainstream media. But of the blogs, of the FI blogs, I would have to say my partner, Grant Sabatier, has a blog called Millennial Money. I really think the world of his work. I've gotten to know him better than anybody else. So I would have to say his blog. But I love some of the other people. I mean, I love Paula Pant. I adore Brandon. You know, Pete, these are great informants.
Do you have this is our question number two. Do you have like a favorite article of all time, either one that you wrote or one of these other individuals, something that they wrote that really stood out to you?
Again, I'm going to be pitifully political, but some of the blogs that have been like the post things I've read online that I haven't gone and gotten the book, but I read it online. One is, I can't recall the man's name, but it's Lessons from the 20th Century on How to Survive Fascism.
All right. Question number three, your favorite life hack.
Sharing. It's half the cost and twice the fun.
That's the shortest answer we've ever had for that. And I love it. I absolutely love it. All right. Question number four, your biggest financial mistake.
This is a financial mistake that wasn't a human mistake, which is I co-owned a house in Seattle and I sold it for $600,000. And about 3 years later, it's worth $1.2 million. And about 2 years before we sold it, it was worth $750,000. So we sold it at the bottom of the market.
Wow.
But what was correct about it was there was a group of people who were living in the house who were doing really well together. And I didn't want to sell the house out from under them. So I sold it when the group decided that they all wanted to go their separate ways.
Well, I'm sure that they appreciated it. Question.
Yeah, right. They're still my friends.
Good. Great nice. Friends.
They're part of my sense of belonging. They're people I can turn to in a rough time. Probably I'll get those $200,000 back in some other way.
Financial interdependence. That's what we're working on.
Exactly.
Question number five, the advice you would give your younger self.
I think it would be just relax. I was so passionate that I became militant, and I may have squozing the pleasure, fun, and joy out of life to a certain degree. So I would say, give yourself some slack, girl.
Fair enough.
All right, Vicky, we have one bonus question. So in the FI community, we generally talk about cutting expenses and I guess cutting things out of your life. But that said, there are certainly times where purchases really enrich our lives. And I'm curious, what's the purchase in the last roughly 12 months or so that's made the most positive impact on your life?
Easy peasy. I bought a used 1984 Sunraider motorhome with a NAP4 Nissan engine in it. I had always wanted, the Sunraider is a unibody fiberglass motorhome. It's just like, I always wanted those. And there was a time when I had sold something and I had $5,000 and I didn't want to put it in investment. And the next thing I saw in a used car lot was that Sunraider, and I go in and I ask about it. They wanted $8,500 and I take it out for a test drive and I come back. I said, this thing's a pig. And the guy says, okay. So what's the maximum you would pay for it? I said, I would like $5,000 out the door, taxes included, maximum. He said, you got a deal, but it's great. I mean, I put in a few hundred dollars into fixing up the engine. I have gone out camping with my friends. You know, it's very different. A tea date to a 3 days in the woods, you know, dive into conversation, spend hours in contemplation on the seashore. It's my go bag. I've got it stocked with survival stuff for if there's a hurricane or, you know, whatever, you know, the earthquake. I love that thing. I mean, it's going to take some work to get everything perfect, but still, that's a great $5,000.
Yes, $5,000 well spent. Vicky, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, man, this has been fabulous, and it makes me even happier to be part of the FI community. And I would love to share the Money Talk cards with your groups, and maybe we can figure out a way that I can talk to group organizers or write a blog post or, you know, just do something to let these groups know that what we have. It would be fabulous. And to have them have a way to report out what they learned from the conversations.
Okay, everybody, Vicki Robin, Your Money or Your Life, updated for 2018, now available wherever books are sold. If you heard this and you want to connect with Vicki, she set up a new website, yourmoneyoryourlife.com, which we will be linking to in the show notes for today's episode. Brad, this was a conversation that was 50 years in the making. And the language that you and I have adopted as our own, that we use basically to create this framework about how we interact with money and how we interact with the trading our time, it's all due to this book. And for me, it was incredible to be able to go behind the scenes on this, basically go right to the source.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think that is truly a fundamental underpinning of financial independence. And I know, like I said in the podcast, I read her book probably 15, 20 years ago and just internalized it. Like, I couldn't tell you precisely when I read it, but that concept of trading your life's energy for money has really always stuck with me. And yeah, that's informed basically my entire adult life. So yeah, to get a chance to speak with her at length like this is really such a treat. And yeah, it's nice to have her back in the fold in the FI community.
All right, guys, if you got value from this episode, if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second, press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. It just lets the providers know that you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional episodes. If you want to support us and what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. If you want to do that, just go to chooseify.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to chooseify.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 38, The Why of FI, and right behind that, have them go listen to episode 21, The Pillars of FI. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.